Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Firesider, a health tonic based on the traditional New England cure-all of raw apple cider vinegar and honey. For more information, visit firesider.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, Greenhorns. This is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers, by young farmers. Today we are talking about soba noodles with sunoco sake. We are interested as young farmers in exploring alternative markets, exploring alternative grains, exploring alternative cover crops, and figuring out how to work within the food system to find good markets for those diverse outcomes of our evolved and evolving agronomy. Welcome to the show, Sunoco.
Hi. Is there any way I could hear you better? I'm just wondering, your voice is very far away.
Yeah, the only thing is we need to get money for Heritage Radio to have better equipment because they are limited.
Okay, so I'm going to just try to...
We're going to ask all our friends to donate to Heritage Radio so they can have better equipment.
All right, well, I'll listen very carefully then.
So welcome to the show, Sunoco. And
thank you.
Would you mind giving a little bit of a backstory on how you discovered the soba noodles and who you are and what you do?
Yes. So I am Sunoco Sakai, and I'm born in New York, but raised in many places, including San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Tokyo, and Kamakura. It's the Kanto region of Japan, and I grew up eating soba noodles, and it was my favorite noodle. When we moved back to the United States, I started to miss those noodles, and the only noodles that you could get here, the only soba noodles that you could get here were the dried, industrially made noodles that were basically almost all wheat, and I just, I just wasn't happy about that. So every time I went back to Japan, I would do a pilgrimage visiting these artisanal noodle places, and then I learned that a lot of the buckwheat was grown right here in the United States, and yet it got all shipped to Japan to be milled into flour. So I started bringing that flour back. I started studying noodle making, and that was about 7 years ago. And so I just became a noodle maker from just wanting to eat those noodles. But it's sort of grown into a bigger purpose, but that's how it all got started, just my passion for good soba noodles.
That's a good passion. That's a good start, isn't it? So let's maybe do a little bit of explaining for our young farmer audience, many of whom are growing vegetables, some of whom are growing grains, many of whom are raising animals, some of whom are starting to think about raising their own feed or blending feeds that are more regional or thinking about non-GMO feeds, and some of whom are having existing client base, sometimes trying to develop new client base, maybe are in relationship with chefs. What are some of the ways that the market is evolving in the kind of soba space? Like, who are the people who are buying and eating the soba noodles, and what opportunity exists there?
Well, soba noodles is buckwheat, and buckwheat is one of the oldest crops that have, you know, that farmers have grown here in the United States. In fact, one the founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson, grew buckwheat, not just for cover crops, which I think most farmers would use it for here, like as a green manure to mellow the soil, but also as food, because wheat back then hadn't taken over. So if you like go back to the old Stephen Foster folk songs, you'll, like Oh Susanna, they think about buckwheat cakes, and that was a staple food, but something happened. Buckwheat kind of got pushed in the background, and wheat just became the primary grain. But I think we are entering a period, and it's not just like people like me who come from I was born here, but I moved back to Japan, grew up in Mexico. I'm bringing back things that I grew up with, I grew up eating with, and we're bringing with us not only we're bringing cultural diversity in the way we eat, but we're also, you know, like I want to use that buckwheat that's turned into manure, so that to be used as food. So I think we are creating these new demands. And so in my case, it's like not farm to table, but table to farm, because I'm saying, God, you know, you grow this buckwheat, please let's figure out how to make this into a commercial, a sustainable grain that farmers could grow, and then we could get millers to mill it, bakers to bake with it, and noodle makers to make noodles with. And so it's a whole educational process that I am involved. And buckwheat is a beautiful crop because it grows very fast. It does not belong to the wheat family. It's not a grass. It's actually part of the rhubarb family. And it only takes 75 days to grow. So you could, a lot of farmers in the Northwest, like in Washington, grow it as a secondary crop. But most of what they grow gets exported to Japan. So I would like to keep the buckwheat here and create a buckwheat economy. And it grows, actually it grows, it adapts quite well to different climates and takes on the terroir of the soil of the place where it grows. So you can enjoy different flavors and crunches, textures, and so I, you know, we're still sort of just starting that process of making these ancient grains other than wheat appealing to Americans.
Well, and so one thing I do know is that there's an increasing number of Americans who are not eating wheat. And we know in the United States that wheat is sprayed often with a desiccant before harvest. There's people in the anti-glyphosate campaign are talking a lot about wheat being sprayed with glyphosate, which is Roundup, causing irritation. Regardless of what the cause is, there's a lot of people who are going wheat-free, gluten-free. Are you seeing an uptick in the demand for buckwheat? And could you talk to that and where that market is kind of going?
Well, you know, I'm not really the grower. I'm the end user. I am a cooking teacher, noodle maker. I do pop-ups around the country. I educate. I go and teach soba noodles or ways to cook with buckwheat. And I have in the last, I started making noodles and teaching noodles about since 2009. And I have seen a tremendous enthusiasm and growth and interest in buckwheat because as you know, a lot of people have gluten intolerance issues, and so this buckwheat is a gluten-free pseudo grain, and nutritiously, it's a complete protein, and also it has lots of antioxidants. So people, I'm finding that people are paying attention to alternative grains, you know, ancient grains. Bakers are becoming interested. Farmers. I have a project in Southern California where I am working with farmers to plant a variety of ancient grains, which include buckwheat. And slowly but surely, we are, I think, creating a market. It takes, it's not a fast process. This is going to take us maybe 3 to 5 years to create a market economy for these, you know, these other varietals, you know, because we've basically just been a wheat culture. So I'm very optimistic that there's going to be a market for, like, maybe we'll have, you know, a good quality flour that people can use to make noodles. And right now, so the quality is basically more for pancakes. It's milled too coarsely. What you could find in the market is a little bit too coarse. But this is all part of our, you know, growing up process, learning how to make a good flour, quality flour that's fresh. I don't treat, you know, I especially treat buckwheat like a fresh fruit. So what I'm aiming for is that freshness. It's not a shelf-stable flour. It should be refrigerated. It should be treated. It should be eaten right away, milled. You know, it's very easy to grow. And once we can all learn how to mill this properly, then it can make a very good noodle that's highly nutritious. And I think it's, we all have to learn how to do this together. You know, I can't just be me eating or making noodles. You know, I have to work with farmers and get them interested in growing buckwheat and not turning it into the soil before it flowers and turns into seed, because it's the seeds that we use to make the buckwheat, you know, to make the flour. And I think it's also good because buckwheat, the bees love buckwheat, and they have a symbiotic relationship where they need each other. You know, buckwheat needs to be pollinated, so, and the buckwheat needs the you know, needs the flowers for their honey. So I think it's a very biodynamic symbiotic relationship that we have going here.
Well, and what the process that you describe of a whole new supply chain, a whole new value chain, or a whole new set of skills and relationships and interlocking market supply and demand, production and culture, the culinary tradition, the appetite for the chef to serve, all of this has, of course, to kind of co-evolve and recover. And that's happening not just in buckwheat, and so it's of interest to, I think, the kind of phenomenology of that is of interest to those of us who are engaged in the project of reforming and reshuffling our food system. One thing I wanted to cover was some of the established markets that we have already that we can look to as guide or analog. You know, a couple of the different culinary traditions that we have seen revived. Right. I'm thinking about specialty soy, you know, specialty soy products. And maybe you could tell me if you're doing any learning across from looking at other products and other culinary traditions about how those kind of reestablish themselves in the wasteland of industrial food.
Well, I think the best example would be the ancient wheats that are coming back. That we, I am working with a seed grant from Anson Mills, which is a miller and farmer based in Glenn Roberts, based in South Carolina, and he has given me seeds, a variety of wheat seeds, ancient wheat seeds, heirloom seeds like Sonora that once used to thrive in the Southwest region, which makes great tortillas and can be used for baking cakes and also in bread making. So these were, and there's also red fife, and there's a variety of grains that were grown in California, yet because the industry moved to the Midwest, the tradition was basically wiped out. But now we have these farmers bringing those back and planting them. You're not huge acres of it. You know, we're just starting very slowly. this is what it is. It's taken us almost a century to wipe out the industry. Now we're not going to be able to recover in a year just because you get tons of seeds and you broadcast it out into fields and harvest it. You know, we have to rebuild an infrastructure, and the infrastructure means not just the farmer, but and the way he is going to take care of the soil. But we have to, the soil needs to be healed, and then there are the bakers, the millers, and the consumers that all have to be part of this process. So we had our second harvest last year of some wheat that we grew in Tehachapi, and we did a trial baking, and it was just the most delicious bread I've ever tasted. So I'm very optimistic that we're going to get there. And we've done some fundraising to buy equipment. I mean, what we're using right now are these, the farmers are using vintage equipment, like a vintage harvester that can, like a combine that can go into the fields and harvest the wheat on a smaller scale, because everything is done in a smaller scale. And it's not industrial scale, you know, thousands and thousands of acres to harvest, but we are keeping it small and see how it goes. So it's a very slow process, but I'm seeing really positive results. The enthusiasm in Southern California is pretty amazing.
So you're saying the market is growing, the appetite is growing, you have some small grain growers growing experimental plots and working with older equipment. One of the questions that I have is how would the infrastructure look if you succeed? So we could look at the wheat example and the heritage grain example, that increasingly bakeries, especially regional bakeries and bakeries that are selling into farmers markets and bakeries that are associated with cafes and with restaurants, are using heritage grains and trading with heritage grains, and increasingly the small and medium-sized mills are buying those grains on a contract basis from growers. In the Southeast, I know that the buckwheat sector is always recruiting new buckwheat growers and putting out advertisements and contracting with growers to grow buckwheat. There's a whole tradition of pancakes from like West Virginia and the Appalachian region, and in Acadia in Canada and northern Maine, there's a whole other buckwheat crepe tradition. So there's these kind of pre-existing models of how these kind of sub-industries are organizing themselves. What would be your vision or goal in terms of buckwheat? How would growers interact with the buckwheat industry as you envision it?
How would they access, you said?
How would they interact?
I think it has to be like a local economy. Like within their region, you know, they should try to create a market that, an infrastructure that will involve the various players, and it may really start very small. You know, buckwheat can also make honey. Buckwheat can be milled into flour. Buckwheat hulls can be made into pillows. But I think you have to find the like-minded people to be willing to take on, to participate in the venture in an experimental way and see where that goes. Because right now, the farmer that received the grant from UNSA Mills is not selling anything. The first thing he did is he said, let's just plant one row. And the row has now turned into like 15 acres. per variety. He has 5 acres, five varieties of wheat. He's also done 2 rows of buckwheat. And the most important thing he did is to see how those ancient grains acclimated to the region, and then he saved the seeds. So that's the first thing you do, is you save seeds, and that's, I guess, any farmer would probably know that. And then as a community of people interested or willing to participate, we have all observed and learned and tasted, and then the market hasn't quite started yet for us. Slowly. Some of the farmers have sold a little bit of the Snora that's grown and milled by the local miller, but I don't really have the numbers, but I think they're slowly approaching the local bakers to see if they would buy it. And I think the price point is also very crucial. You know, if you make it too expensive, they will shy away and they would rather go the industrial route, right, than to go to the local, smaller grower route. So these are things that it's a process that we're learning, and we don't have answers for everything, but I think each region has to find their own answers. But we also gather together, I go to the grain growers, the grain gathering conference in Washington. Dr. Stephen Jones leads the Washington State University Bread Lab, and there's about 300 or 400 people that come there, scientists, bakers, noodle makers, grain enthusiasts, to exchange information and see what kind of varieties go well and what people are doing all around the world. So it's an educational process also.
One thing I know is that each region has its own gifts and challenges and different infrastructure to build from. One avenue I wonder about and would love to explore, especially as we're looking at the generational transition with organic, where even in organic we have a majority of growers still in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and an incoming generation who are in their 20s and 30s and much less proportionately in their 40s and 50s. And that's just a statistical basis, or that's the reality we're dealing with. So one of the questions, therefore, becomes, how do these young businesses interact with the supply chain? And what kind of a gentle way in could there be? And so one of the questions I wonder about is the organic industry, so people who make cookies and crackers and baked goods and stuff that's on shelves and in packages, everything from burritos to cookies, those companies, could they buy a little bit of their supply chain, especially in their non-wheat areas? Could they be buying more regionally? Could there be partnerships developed between some of those organic companies and these incoming growers, where the growers are able to start scaling into a contract?
I think so. I think that's actually starting to happen.
Tell me about it. That sounds exciting.
Producers want to go directly, like producer to producer, like manufacturer to producer, or instead of having a lot of middlemen in between, you want to go directly to the grower. So maybe a baker wants to work directly with a farmer to source that single variety of buckwheat or wheat and brand it as a local product. I mean, that's already starting to happen with wheat. And so I think I'm all for localism, localizing it, so we don't, have to. We can minimize our carbon footprint. But I think there's. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
that's okay. I mean, I'm just kind of exploring the idea, and I think all the people who are going to be listening are going to be thinking through what makes sense for themselves.
Yeah.
Also, I guess in conclusion, one of the follow-up questions would just be, how do we learn, how do people who are listening who are all of a sudden getting jazzed on buckwheat and thinking, oh, shucks, I could do that, where do they learn about buckwheat? Where do they find good buckwheat seeds? How do they sign up for your classes?
I am a mobile teacher. I'm a mobile cooking teacher. I teach on the West Coast, from Los Angeles all the way up to San Francisco, Seattle. And I've taught in Chicago. I'm going to actually be going to Charleston, South Carolina, to teach at the Culinary Institute next week. And I've been invited by Ansel Mills to do some work in buckwheat. So here's... You know, I'm a very mobile cooking teacher, noodle maker, and anyone that wants to, anyone that has questions or want to learn could take my class or email me with questions. I have a website called cooktellsastory.com, and if you go to there, I also have another one called commongrains.com, but it just needs to be updated. So if you go to cooktellsastory.com, you will see all the events that I'm doing, all the cooking events I do, the pop-ups I do. I try to stay as active as possible. I work with universities. I work with private institutions. I work with chefs, collaborate with chefs. Any place I any place I can find, I will go because I want to spread the. It's for me. It's like a life mission. It's like the spreading the gospel of buckwheat.
Yeah, spreading the gospel of buckwheat.
Does that make sense? I don't know if that's good English, but that's how I feel. I don't know what it is, but this plant has completely taken over my life.
Yeah, it makes more sense than it does dollars, but that's the case with everybody in agriculture. So, we're in good company with each other, I think, all of us. So, we come to the end of our time, and I'm really thankful for your interview. I have a few announcements for the Greenhorns people. One of those announcements is it's almanac time. Henry and Charlie and I and Nicole, we have put together the list of chapter topics and assignments, but we are open to submission. And we are open to submission until the end of February, but we would prefer if you send us a line to almanac@thegreenhorns.org stating your intentions. What are you intending to write about, and giving us a little heads up so we can start formulating how the thing fits together. And then you can also join the reminder mailing list that will help you stay on track with the deadline for the 2017 almanac. So with that, it's raining on the West Coast. Praise the Lord. And I hope you all have a cozy, nice place to be. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.